In this episode,
I have seen a lot of clinicians go ahead and shape the tooth, prepare the tooth, make the impression, and then sit in discussion with the patient. Okay, do you want metal? Do you want ceramic? Do you want zirconia? And it baffles me. Right, Mayur, which means in chronological sequence, you would first have to sit with the patient and understand what the patient needs, what the patient wants, and what is achievable for that particular clinical situation. Just for those audiences who are not aware of what an endocrown is, you have an endodontically treated tooth where you have a central access cavity. You don't fill the access cavity. Right, you just do the regular occlusal reduction. You may or may not open proximal contacts. Now that's dependent whether there is. The worst place, Mayur, for enamel to be is down the suction drain. Ceramic tile is very weak by itself, but once it is cemented to the wall, it becomes so strong that you can't break it. Now that's exactly how lithium disilicate works. So the one big takeaway that I would want a lot of clinicians to take from this podcast is...
This is episode 1 of season 3, that is the season of prosthodontics with Dr. Moez Khakyani. Dr. Moez Khakyani is an MDS in prosthodontics and maintains a private practice in Bandra, Mumbai since 2006 with special attention towards fixed prosthodontics, functional smile designing, full mouth reconstructions, and TMJ pain management. He is a fellow of ICOI, PFA, and ICD. He holds a postgraduate diploma in aesthetic and cosmetic dentistry from State University of Buffalo, New York since 2007. He is the author of the highly acclaimed book titled Clinical Fixed Prosthodontics, for which he has been bestowed multiple awards. He is the co-founder of MIK Dental with 7 design patents registered under his name. Whoa. He is a key opinion leader with companies like 3M, Colgate, Medicept, IPCA Pharmaceuticals, Abbott, Septodont, and Hugh Freddy. He has to his credit several papers and publications at various conferences in India and overseas, and is a highly acclaimed speaker for his clinically relevant topics. We all know that. He has over 350 podium lectures at various state, national, and international conferences, dental colleges, and is the director for ProstoTrain, under which banner he conducts CDE courses and hands-on workshops. He has personally trained over 3,000 dentists for crown and bridge dentistry, ceramic laminates, occlusion, full mouth rehabilitations, and TMJ disorders with live patient demonstrations. Welcome to the show, Moez. I'm so grateful you could give us your valuable time.
Indeed, an absolute pleasure, Mayur. This is such a wonderful platform to be on. Who better than the person who introduced dental photography to the country to now introduce the podcast to the wonderful country of India. Thank you so very much for having me on your show, my friend.
It is my pleasure and absolute honor. We are looking for a lot of episodes together, because let us discuss all about prosthodontics and everything that you want to share with the audience in all our forthcoming episodes.
We start today.
Let me start directly from your book, because I love to read your book. And in your book, Clinical Fixed Prosthodontics, you have enumerated all the prosthetic options available to us today, subdividing them into 2 categories, namely multi-layered and monolithic. For beginners who are listening to this podcast, multi-layered basically means that there is more than one type of material in its design, in which we have examples like PFM or porcelain fused to metal, porcelain fused to zirconia, and even porcelain fused to lithium disilicate. And the monolithic basically means the entire structure is made up of one material only, which has options like metal, zirconia, lithium disilicate, composite resin, and fluorspathic porcelain. So Moez, there's one sentence in the book that I really appreciate, which reads like this. In choosing the prosthesis type and material used, clinical judgment should reign above mechanical denominators and mathematical figures, ensuring that each clinical decision is case-specific and not dictated by commercial or financial interest. This is something I feel everyone must get it printed on their office walls. And I couldn't agree more on this.
Thank you so very much, Mayur, for that. Before I justify this to you and to the audience that is hearing this podcast, clinical fixed prosthodontics is our baby. I remember the journey that we've gone through to clicking pictures, to putting the contents together, to launching the book, and then seeing it being accepted and liked by so many. So it's a privilege to have you on board the same. Thank you so very much for that. Those memories will always stay with us. Absolutely. So Mayur, talking about this very statement, I personally feel it is unfortunate that our undergraduate curriculum does not define the choice of prosthetic material from a clinical perspective. Most often than not, it is theoretical. And a lot of what we read in our books probably are not in vogue today, for the simple reason that dentistry over the last decade or so has transformed so significantly, and material science has developed so much that materials that have been used for documentation in the book are probably obsolete. One such example is gold. As much as I would love to use gold in my patient's mouth, including my own mouth, it's not something that's feasible, right? And materials like lithium disilicate, zirconia, that are so much an everyday practice for all clinicians today, were not present at the time when these books were scripted, which is the reason why it's unfortunate that clinicians always find themselves in a dilemma that in a particular clinical situation, what am I supposed to do? It is not a single material suits all criteria anymore. Mm-hmm. Anterior teeth, posterior teeth, you have people with reduced occlusal clearance, you have individuals with different sizes of pulp chambers. There are so many different factors that determine the choice of prosthetic material in a patient's mouth. One should not run behind only numbers. When I say numbers, I'm talking about strength. See, one of the biggest fears that clinicians have, and of course I have had for the longest of times, is failures in terms of porcelain fracture, all right, which is often the reason why people immediately jump to choosing that something stronger. If it's stronger, it's not going to break. What clinicians need to understand is if something is excessively strong and is not going to break, something else will break. So imagine your restoration is so strong that it's not breaking, but the underlying tooth, which is your abutment tooth, has fractured. I always think of it like this, Mayur. If a patient walks into my practice and needs a prosthetic replacement, right? There are two approaches. One is the abutment approach, one is the prosthesis approach. Now, what does the abutment approach say? The abutment approach, my friend, says think of the abutment and choose a softer material that goes on top. A softer material will absorb the stresses, will protect the tooth. All right. On the other hand, if I look at only my prosthesis, that my prosthesis should not fail in the patient's mouth, I may land up choosing, let's say, a monolithic zirconia for the simple reason that someone told me even if I were to hit it with a hammer, it will not break. Logically, if the prosthesis will not break, your abutment is going to give. Either the periodontal ligament will go mobile, there will be food lodgement between teeth, there will be contacts that open up, there could be gingival recession. Worst case scenario is a horizontal fracture. How often has it happened, Mayur? Your patient comes to you saying, "Doc, this cap has come out." And when you look inside the cap is when you see that entire crown portion. You look into the patient's mouth and the tooth has fractured at the gingival level. And my thought process, Mayur, is if the prosthesis breaks, it can be replaced. It's that simple. If the abutment fractures, oh my God, now you're talking about an implant and a cyclic journey begins. All right. So in my opinion, not running behind mechanical values of 1,000 megapascals and this strength and that strength. I mean, it's all about using your clinical expertise and experience and choosing a material that best suits that particular situation, right? And then, of course, we are surrounded by so many good materials in dentistry today. It's not like before that we had to choose only between metal and PFM. Today, we have a plethora of materials that are available. And as time moves by, I am so happy to share that more and more of hybrid prosthetic materials are coming in that are giving you porcelain and composite together. So porcelain gives you aesthetics. Composite is going to give you that buffering capacity. Put both of these together and single unit restorations are not just looking good, but also surviving the test of times. And I couldn't be happier with the time frame that we are born, because there is so much happening in prosthetic dentistry that I can only see us moving forward and growing in our clinical application of the different materials available to us.
That is exactly why we are discussing this topic today, because as we see more and more clinical options with respect to the prosthetic materials that are available, it becomes even more important for the youngsters as well as the clinicians to understand what is the best material for what kind of a patient. So I move on to my next question, right? So can you give us a rundown on all the factors you always take into consideration before you finalize your material option for a particular case, giving examples as you explain, like what all do you consider? Do you consider tooth location, length of edentulous span, or parafunctional habits, or color of the underlying tooth? What is it that you always take into consideration as a rule? And it's of prime importance for all the clinician to consider before they round up on any particular prosthetic material choice.
All right, that's a wonderful question, Mayur. Before I give an answer to that one, let me quickly tell you something that I have realized as a consultant when I used to go around different clinics. I have seen a lot of clinicians commit a simple yet very grave mistake, right? And what would that mistake be? I have seen a lot of clinicians go ahead and shape the tooth, prepare the tooth, make the impression, and then sit in discussion with the patient. Okay, do you want metal? Do you want ceramic? Do you want zirconia? And it baffles me. It baffles me because the preparation protocol is subjective to the prosthetic material chosen. Right, Mayur, which means in chronological sequence, you would first have to sit with the patient and understand what the patient needs, what the patient wants, and what is achievable for that particular clinical situation. Right, so decide on your prosthetic material first, and on the basis of that clinical decision, should you go ahead and prepare the tooth, right? What do you do different in terms of tooth preparation? I'm sure we could take that as a separate podcast altogether. But for now, let me come to giving an answer to the question that you have posed, Mayur. So if a patient walks in, the first thought that I have in my head is, am I doing restoration for an anterior tooth or am I doing restoration for a posterior tooth? Right. If it's for an anterior tooth, I know for a fact that my patient's priority is going to be good looks. It's going to be aesthetics, which means I'm going to immediately start thinking in terms of a metal-free restoration. Now, when I say a metal-free restoration, first in that series for me is this beautiful material called as lithium disilicate. Of course, for years across the globe, this is synonymous to the word EMAX. The reason why we think of lithium disilicate for anteriors is because it has fairly good strength and it has fairly good aesthetics. Now, it is often said that lithium disilicate, being a crystalline material, is an ideal enamel replacement material. As we all know, enamel is also crystalline. It's all inorganic, right? So if I'm looking at replacing enamel, be it with a partial bonded laminate or veneer, or be it with a full coverage crown, I am always thinking of giving my patient the most aesthetic result, right? If it's a single anterior tooth, my priority is to match it to the adjacent tooth. And if the adjacent tooth has a lot of nature in it, when I say nature, I'm talking about the incisal edge halo. If that is a very youthful tooth, it is going to need a lithium disilicate for the technician to be able to give a biomimetic looking restoration. Now, on the other hand, if that same tooth, even if it's for an anterior, is discolored significantly, I am now fearful of using lithium disilicate. Because remember, lithium disilicate's biggest advantage is its translucency. Now, if the underlying tooth is extremely opaque, be it discolored or if it has a cast post or if it has some form of filling that's a completely different color, my technician is not going to be able to mask it in the best possible manner, right? These are cases where the stump shade guide also comes in. Now again, that's something that we will take as a separate podcast, which is to do with shade selection. But remember, if you have a discolored underlying tooth, lithium disilicate's advantage of translucency actually becomes a disadvantage. Right, so I might not think in terms of using a very translucent material. So what do I now think about? I think about using an opaque core material. Priority, of course, would be to now use a zirconia fused to porcelain. All right, so you have porcelain which is layered on top of a coping that is made in zirconia. All right, so this is the metal-free option. Now, zirconia being an opaque material can easily mask the underlying tooth color and allow for your technician to give you a good aesthetic end result. Of course, for decades, we have been using porcelain fused to metal PFMs, which is also a very viable option, right? The only concern that I have had for years with PFM is the fact that you need aggressive tooth preparation. Right, because you have a metal layer, you have two layers of opaque, you have dentin porcelain, enamel porcelain, then you have a glaze layer on top. It just makes the restoration thicker. And if the restoration is thicker, you need more underlying tooth preparation. And remember, the more aggressive you are, the less conservative you are. And today the world is moving towards conservation. Right, so if you want to conserve an anterior tooth and if you want to give a lifelike restoration, think first about lithium disilicate. If that is not possible, think in terms of porcelain fused to zirconia. You may also do monolithic zirconias. These days you have pre-stained zirconia materials that give you fairly decent results. Mm-hmm. Right, it may probably not match the aesthetics of an EMAX. But it's there, it's getting there. And of course you have your porcelain fused to metal. Right. So that is what I'm thinking in my head if the patient walks in and needs an anterior tooth replacement. Now imagine if I'm doing a posterior tooth, be it a vital tooth or be it an endodontically treated tooth. Right? Posterior tooth is not as much about aesthetics, but is more to do with function and more to do with strength and longevity. So what am I thinking in my head? Now, this may come as a surprise to a lot of viewers out there, a lot of you hearing me. If it's a single tooth restoration, I would still think of doing an EMAX and not a crown. Now, when I say an EMAX, I am talking about a partial bonded restoration, which means an onlay or an overlay or an endocrown. I am not someone who enjoys doing crown preparation as much, right? Now, how often have we all struggled with this clinical scenario where the patient comes in with a grossly decayed tooth, right? Now, what have I done if I have to do a root canal? I've created a large central access. So I've taken a chunk of tooth structure away. Now I've done a core buildup and now I do a full crown prep. And as a part of the crown prep, I have taken the peripheral enamel away. Now that enamel is the strongest structure in the human body, right? I call enamel the expensive currency of the oral cavity, right? My patient deserves to keep that enamel. Mm-hmm. The worst place, Mayur, for enamel to be is down the suction drain, right? It should hurt you. I'm telling you, if you're a kind-hearted person, it should hurt you to cut enamel. I would not want someone to cut my tooth enamel. And I know it's an irreplaceable act, right? So if I've done a central access cavity and I've done a peripheral crown pep, I'm thinking to myself, how much of the original tooth structure now remains? There's hardly anything, all right? And all of that is soft composite or is softer dentin. And on top of that, I put an enamel replacement crown and I expect that dentin to take care of that prosthesis, making sure it does not fracture. It is asking for too much from that underlying bone structure. Right? An unfortunate scenario, if the tooth breaks or if the prosthesis fractures, the first thing we do is we complain to the technician. Little do we know that it was probably our mistake in terms of choosing the prosthetic material. So imagine, Mayur, if I were to do an overlay or a crown lay, and if I've just prepped the occlusal surface of the tooth, I am thinking to myself, worst case scenario, something happens. It's not going to happen to the tooth. It's only and only going to happen to the prosthesis. So what can I do? I can replace the prosthesis. I call this plan B dentistry. Right? Always give that tooth a second chance to live. Right? It's like CPR for that tooth. Okay, so I'm still thinking in terms of a lithium disilicate. I might go in for a porcelain fused to zirconia. In a situation where the amount of bonding surface is not adequate. So remember, lithium disilicate is an etchable material that has to be bonded to tooth, which means you can't be mixing GIC and cementing it. It'll fracture. Mm-hmm. You need for it to monoblock, which means you need for it to bond. You need a resin cement. Mm-hmm. Now, if there is not enough amount of enamel present, right? Or if I'm not doing a single crown, but I'm doing a three-unit bridge prosthesis, let's say, for example. Mm-hmm. I cannot be using lithium disilicate in this scenario. So what will I do? I will use a porcelain fused to zirconia, or I will use a porcelain fused to metal. Right? And something that I am always looking out for is the amount of clinical crown height. Because that's one of the most common concerns that we have, especially for posterior teeth, where after having done occlusal preparation, there's hardly adequate amount of axial tooth height available. So what's one of my biggest fears? That prosthesis will decement or it'll come out and my patient will keep coming back to me and I'll be lost what to do in that scenario. In such a scenario is where a bonded prosthesis in the form of an endo crown works brilliantly well. So if you have a short clinical crown, an endo crown, which just for those audiences who are not aware of what an endo crown is, you have an endodontically treated tooth where you have a central access cavity. You don't fill the access cavity, all right? You just do the regular occlusal reduction. You may or may not open proximal contacts. Now that's dependent whether there is caries present there or not, right? So when the prosthesis comes back, the prosthesis is like an occlusal dome with a small umbrella-like extension that goes into the access cavity, right? Which means your access cavity is not filled with composite, but is filled with porcelain. So the enamel that surrounds the periphery of the tooth is going to give you your macro retention or your bonding, while the core inside is going to give you micro retention. Now, what's the advantage? Because I don't have to do any axial reduction, I am not concerned about the clinical crown height. All I need is around a 1.5 millimeter of occlusal clearance. And if I have that much, which I believe every tooth has, that is all I need. And because it's bonded, I am not fearful that it will come out. Right? Having said that, let me also put in another perspective here, Mayur. If you ask me for a single tooth, would I choose a lithium disilicate or will I choose a porcelain fused to zirconia? I will still say lithium disilicate. Lithium disilicate is by itself a very weak material. Now, when I say weak material, on an average, they say between 350 to 400 megapascals is its strength, which means agar haath se girta hai niche, toh possibility hai chip ho jayega, right? On the other hand, zirconia is very strong. But remember, if you're doing a zirconia core, which has like 1,000 megapascals of strength, but if you're doing a ceramic overlay, which means it's a porcelain fused to zirconia, the weakest link is not the zirconia, but is the overlying porcelain. Now that porcelain has only about 100 megapascal strength, which means the possibility of porcelain in a PFZ breaking is far more than your monolithic Emacs breaking. So although Emacs per se is weaker, remember, once bonded, it becomes very hard. I often give my students and my patients this analogy, that think of a ceramic tile. A ceramic tile is very weak by itself, but once it is cemented to the wall, it becomes so strong that you can't break it. And that's exactly how lithium disilicate works. So the one big takeaway that I would want a lot of clinicians to take from this podcast is, start thinking, friends, in terms of bonded dentistry, Emacs, and partial preparations, right? As far as possible, do not do full crown preps, because I just feel it's excessively invasive, right? You're taking a lot of good tooth structure away. The basic concept for crown prep is you weaken the tooth by prepping it so that you can replace a prosthesis and make it strong again. I mean, why do it? Right? If you can keep the original tooth structure intact, remember, nothing that's prosthetic can match what is natural. All right. So these are a few very important aspects that I will always look at, Mayur. Having said that, remember, at the end of the day, it all comes down to how skilled your laboratory technician is, and how confident and competent you are in executing the prosthetic replacement for the patient. Because lithium disilicate, as I always love to say, is female in nature, right? It needs a little bit of pampering, it needs care, it needs excessive preparation, it needs etching, it needs silanization, it needs a resin cement, but it's all worth it at the end of the day, because those restorations then last the patients for decades together. And if you have a happy patient, you have a happy community. And most importantly for me, you sleep well at night.
Yeah, so true. Do you also take into account the size of the pulp when you decide the prosthesis, especially when it comes to a young vitality?
Oh, yes, absolutely, Mayo. This is a concern, especially for those individuals who need prosthetic replacement at a fairly young age. Now, what happens is with time and with function or with use or abuse, the pulpal tissue begins to recede. And as it recedes, it allows you more amount of tooth material to prepare without the fear of invading the pulpal tissue. Now if you're doing a prosthetic replacement for a younger individual, you are always fearful that as a part of your prep, you may land up opening the pulp chamber. Right. And if that happens, you're always in a questionable situation whether the pulp will continue to survive over an extended period of time or not. Right. So a simple thought process here is, if you have a younger tooth, do a semi-permanent restoration. When I say a semi-permanent restoration, I'm thinking in terms of a heat cure acrylic resin prosthesis, right? Something that is lab fabricated and something that will survive the patient for a few years until the time comes where the pulp has receded enough for you to go ahead and replace it with a definitive prosthesis. And also, when you're doing a definitive prosthesis, like what you started off saying in the introduction, Mayur, think of monolithic restorations. Don't think of multi-layered restorations. Because remember, in general, a monolithic restoration will need lesser amount of preparation because it does not have multiple layers to create the final anatomy. So think of a monolithic restoration over a multi-layered restoration for a younger tooth. At the same time, think in terms of a semi-permanent followed by a definitive replacement as age goes by.
Right. And then in that, you want heat-cured resin material for those kind of patients that is fabricated from the lab, and not try too much with cold cure resins. That's such an important takeaway, because that might irritate the pulp more if you're trying to do something in the
clinic. Precisely.
That's precisely. Amazing. Amazing tips given by you for the first question, the second question, in fact. So I'm moving on to the next question. All that you said is fitting perfectly. And since we are talking about the materials, let us discuss the fabrication techniques in a nutshell, because this might be of great help to all the students and fresh pass outs as well. So can you throw some light on what is the basic meaning of terms like casting, what do you mean by milling or block milling, DMLS, CAD-CAM, pressing, etc.?
Okay. Let me start off by saying dental materials, or although it is a part of something that we learned during the first year of our bachelor curriculum, is way more important in clinical practice than it was in answering theory questions and passing an exam. Right? I remember being haunted, Mayur, by this question of casting defects.
Absolutely.
And topics like suck back porosity, and I'm wondering to myself, what am I doing in this field of dentistry? Right? I thought casting was for jewelry.
In fact, I used to think, what the hell is dye materials? Why do you have to dye materials in dentistry?
Exactly. I mean, dyeing is something that you do for clothes to give it color, don't you?
Yes.
I do it for my hair so that I don't have salt pepper on me.
It's really difficult, I believe, to study dental materials in the first year of dentistry. Somehow it gets clearer in the final years later on.
Exactly.
But in the first year and second year, it's really difficult to understand it to the absolute fullest.
Correct. And the reason that is because, Mayur, we are having to imagine a lot of what is being written there, not having seen or heard any of that in our professional lives. If we were second generation dentists, of course, life probably would have been different, but unfortunately, we don't belong to that cluster of the world, which means for us, everything was so new that we had to teach ourselves to first learn the concept and then probably understand its relevance in our professional lives as we move forward, right? So casting, I'm sure, is something that a lot of our audiences would have read and heard about. It's to do with the lost wax technique, mm-hmm. and melting metal and then kind of pushing it through a centrifugal machine. Mm-hmm. Right now, casting is associated with a lot of errors in terms of the compensation of the expansion of dye material and shrinkage of the metal as it goes from a hotter to a cooler atmosphere. What does this mean? The preciseness in fit of a prosthesis is questionable if you have a multi-unit casted prosthesis, right? Now, the concern here is single tooth, you will still be able to fit it down fairly easily. But when you go to a multi-unit restoration, casting may land up creating discrepancies, especially at the margins, right? And I always love to say this, prostho is all about precision and passion, right? So the precision aspect is where casting, in a lot of senses, did not provide what we were looking for. Although this may be a theoretical answer, but if there is a margin that is more than 100 microns open, it is called as a leaky margin. Mm. This is where you have secondary leakage. It's not uncommon for us to remove an old crown and only to see that the margins have gone black. It's nothing but micro leakage that has occurred there. And this happens if the marginal opening is more than 100 microns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, the human eye cannot perceive 100 microns. Mm. Right now, this is a fact. So if you were to look at your margin and think, I don't see a gap, there may actually be a gap. It's just that our eyes are not tuned enough to appreciate that gap. Okay. On the other hand, if your eye can see that gap, oh my God, that's no longer in micron.
That's in kilometer.
Please. I'm looking at air miles here now. Okay, do not go ahead and cement that crown needs a replacement, sure, friends. Please, sure. It's not worth it. You may give it to the patient and forget about it, but remember, your patient has to live the rest of his or her life with that. And as part of doing ethical dentistry, I don't think we as honorable human individuals should go ahead and indulge in these kind of practices. Sure. Now, Fortunately, that is where the CAD-CAM technology found its place during our generation, right? And milling as a concept came in, right? Now, milling is actually of two types. There is reductive milling and there is additive milling. Now, what is reductive milling? Reductive milling is something that's very commonly done for metal or zirconia. You have blocks or blanks of these materials that are put into a CAM machine. That's your computer-aided milling. And there is a burr or a drill that reduces the block to provide a specific shape. So as logically as this sounds, it is reductive form of CAD-CAM milling. On the other hand, if you're looking at an additive form of CAD-CAM milling, that is where your DMLS comes in. That's your direct metal laser sintering. Now, what does this do? This takes powdered form of metal and it has a specific laser that flashes on specific areas, providing the metal particles to kind of congregate together and start forming thin layers. As layer by layer by layer keeps adding on top of itself, over a period of time, the entire thing takes the shape of a prosthesis, either a coping or a monolithic restoration. All right, so that's the difference between milling reductive and milling additive. Right? The only thing that here now remains to understand is a concept of heat pressing, which is to do with lithium disilicate. Now, friends, lithium disilicate is available in two forms, right? Either in an ingot form or in a block form. The block form is very simple to use. You put it in a machine and the machine mills it down. What I love about this block form is it often comes in a purple color, right? So if you see a purple color crown, don't wonder what that is. It is an Emax material in the form of a block that has been milled by subtractive technique. Okay. Now, if you have an ingot of Emax, what do you do with it? You first go ahead and make a wax up, just like how you do a wax up for a crown. You get your wax up ready. You go ahead and invest it. Right. This is with the use of the dye material, which is very, very similar to the casting technique.
Right.
Same as the casting technique, you put it into a furnace, you burn out the wax, which means you now have a cavity inside. Right? Now, casting mein kya karte hai, Mayur? We put metal into a centrifugal machine, and with the help of centrifugal force, we push the metal into that space that is created by the melt out of the wax. Heat pressing is slightly different. Heat pressing mein hum jo ingot hota hai, usko melt karte hai by taking it to a certain temperature. And then with the help of a piston, we push it down. And as we push the molten Emax down, it kind of flows into that cavity and provides the desired end form. All right. So casting and heat pressing are very similar in terms of the procedure that goes up to the wax melting. And after that, for metal, you use a centrifuge. For Emax, you use a pressing piston. All right, so that's how the differentiation between the different protocols that laboratory technicians can use to fabricate our prosthesis. Now, it's important for all clinicians not to just be aware of the prosthetic materials, but also the techniques, because the accuracy in fit for all of these eventually does have clinical significance, especially if you're not talking about just tooth-based dentistry, but implant-based dentistry, because that's all about getting the fit
right,
kind of tuned down perfectly.
Right, right. It's such a good answer that you gave, and all these techniques are important for clinicians to understand, because it's related to the prognosis of the case that we are planning for the patient, because it all narrows down to the clinical fit, about how heavy the prosthesis, and so many considerations, especially in implant prosthesis. So we are going to talk about all these techniques and materials in detail, about how to prep the tooth and other aspects of the prosthetic materials in our forthcoming episodes of the 32 Minute Podcast with Dr. Moez Kakiani. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much. It was such an honor and a pleasure to have you. How was your experience with the first episode that we conducted just now.
Oh, it was absolutely stunning, Mayur. The very fact that podcasts need not take attention away in terms of your visual appeal. All it needs is for you to have a present mind and a good thought process that's going in. So you could be driving, you could be sitting, you could be doing something else, and you have your earphone in, and you can learn so much without actually having to look at a screen. Because as much as we've all enjoyed webinars during the lockdown phase, we know how much toll it now takes on us to simply see a screen. Thank you so very much for hosting me here, for giving me this opportunity to be on this lovely platform of 32-minute podcast. I look forward to doing more and more and more of these as time goes by. Wishing you and wishing all the audiences out there a fantastic day ahead. Friends, stay safe, stay happy. Until we hear each other again.
Yep, absolutely. Looking forward to see you in the next episode. Thank you and bye-bye. That is all we have time for in this episode of the 32-minute podcast. To check out all our episodes, blogs, contests, or events, log on to www.32minute.com. If you have any questions for any of the speakers interviewed on my show, or if you want me to interview someone you would like to listen to, you can send in your suggestions on podcast@32minute.com. If you like this show, do leave me a review and rating on your preferred platform. This is your host, Dr. Mayur, signing off for now. I'll meet you in the next episode of the 32-minute podcast. Till then, keep listening, keep learning.